DamascusCitizens.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello.
Country, locally produced radio about rural life in the Catskills and the Delaware River Valley. On today's show, Keith Hubbard has a Star Talk report that describes how astronomers determine the distance to the stars. Sweetwater fishing guide Evan Padua shares his cold water spring report on the Upper Delaware River for several species using specific techniques. Mark Gidley, arborist living in Henkins, New York, visits with Stephanie Phillips. In this segment, Now You Know, you'll hear practical information about keeping our trees healthy and happy. All of that coming up country here on Radio Catskill. But first, news headlines from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Barbara Klein. Johnson & Johnson's coronavirus vaccine is back in use today after an 11-day pause over concerns about rare cases of blood clots. NPR's Giles Snyder reports health officials say the benefits far outweigh any risk.
Advisors to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the Food and Drug Administration say the risk of developing blood clots after taking the J&J shot is very low, according to a CDC analysis of 8 million J&J shots given with no serious complications. 15 cases of unusual blood clots were found, all of them in women aged 18 to 59. 3 of them died, and 7 are still hospitalized. The FDA says it will warn of the risk of a likely association in an updated fact sheet to help women decide if they should get the J&J shot or seek an alternative. The decision follows a similar go-ahead by the European Medicines Agency. Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Authorities in Nashville, Tennessee are investigating a fatal police shooting during a traffic stop overnight. Chaz Sisk of member station WPLN reports.
Body camera footage shows a one-minute encounter in which a man emerges from a car that's been pulled over on a busy corridor. Within seconds, the officer pulls his pistol and orders the man to drop a kitchen knife. After briefly running away, the man turns toward the officer, who fires 3 shots. Nashville Police Chief John Drake alluded to the scrutiny being paid to such incidents.
When I got the call this morning, I had mixed emotions, especially with all that's going on around the nation and in this city, to say.
Even before the shooting, activists had been planning demonstrations in Nashville today. They're spurred by the killings of a community activist and a 3-year-old girl in the same area earlier this month. Those did not involve police officers. For NPR News, I'm Chaz Sisk in Nashville.
A Minnesota court says former police officer Derek Chauvin will be sentenced June 16th for murder and manslaughter in the death of George Floyd. Myanmar's coup leader is in Indonesia for a weekend summit of Southeast Asian nations. As Michael Sullivan reports, leaders are urging him to end a violent crackdown on protesters.
It's believed to be Senior General Min Aung Hlaing's first trip outside the country since the coup. The leaders of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations hope he'll listen to their pleas to bring an end to the bloodshed that's followed the coup amid neighboring countries' fears of an influx of refugees. The leaders of Thailand, Laos, and the Philippines aren't attending the in-person summit, 3 countries experiencing a spike in coronavirus infections in the past week.
Security forces have killed at least 700 people since the coup. This is NPR.
Support comes from Van Gorder's Furniture, featuring Lodge and Adirondack styles as well as rustic collections. With showrooms at Lake Wallenpaupack, downtown Honesdale, and Milford, PA, Van Gorder's Furniture brings the outdoors inside. VanGorders.com.
This is Rosie Starr. Welcome back to Farm and Country. Coming up, we have Sweetwater fishing guide Evan Padua sharing his cold water spring report on the Upper Delaware River for several species using specific techniques. Mark Gidley, arborist living in Henkins, New York, visits with Stephanie Phillips. In the segment Now You Know, you'll hear practical information about keeping our trees healthy and happy. First up is Keith Hubbard with a Star Talk report that describes how astronomers determine the distance to the stars. Thank you for joining us for this week's locally produced Farm and Country.
Country, I'm Keith Hubbard, and this is Star Talk. Have you wondered how astronomers determine the distance to stars? There are several methods that astronomers can use. Astronomers use a technique called parallax to measure the distance to nearby stars. By nearby stars, we mean stars up to 330 light years away. Astronomers measure parallax by observing the position of a nearby star with respect to the background stars, then repeating the observation 6 months later when the Earth is on the opposite side of its orbit. When comparing the two observations, the nearby star will shift slightly with respect to the background stars. The shift is very minute, less than an arc second for even the closest stars to Earth. Proxima Centauri, the nearest star, has the largest observed parallax of 0.772 arc seconds. One arc second is 1/60th of an arc minute, and one arc minute is 1/60th of a degree. This shift, or parallax, reveals the star's distance to Earth. You can see how this works by holding your thumb at arm's length in front of you. Close one eye and then the other. Notice how your thumb moved relative to the background objects? This effect is called parallax and is what astronomers measure. The greater the distance to the star, the smaller the parallax, and the less precise the distance measurement will be. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for future StarTalk segments, my email address is startalk@farmandcountry.org. For Farm and Country and StarTalk, this has been Keith Hubbard, reminding you to keep looking up.
For WJFF and Farm and Country, this is Evan Padua bringing you Hooked on Fishing.
Welcome back to the open water fishing season of 2021. I am happy to be back on the Upper Delaware River, guiding fishing trips daily and fishing surrounding waters on my couple of days off through the spring season. As the water temperatures in our area have been slowly climbing over the past few weeks, most fish are having increases in their metabolic rate, which in turn leads them to feed more frequently than during the cold of winter. Basically, they need more food to survive as water warms. And the spring is a great time to wet a line, for all types of species. Small mountain streams in New York and Pennsylvania both offer great cold water trout fishing this time of year. Usually subsurface baits or fly patterns are best for cold water trout fishing in the early spring. This holds true on the Upper Delaware River as well. While increasing the weight of size and lures may be required in bigger bodies of water. However, small bat black woolly buggers or jig patterns fished for trout can also yield good bites. An 1/8-ounce jig head or an 1/8-ounce metal spinner is great for spring fishing. Fishing our area's lakes for spring perch can be very productive. Use a light line and fish small, flashy spinners or flies, moving fast from deep to shallow water. Perch cannot resist them. Light test line, 4 to 8 pound test, is best used in most of our area's rivers, streams, and lakes, especially in the early season, when the water is cold, low, and clear. More fish will bite while using lighter test line. In turn, it is important to understand the drag system of your reel. so you do not break your line at inopportune moments. Be sure to double-check your knots for strength and line abrasions. Being diligent at these practices will yield more catches and more fish on the line. The spring shad run has begun. The American shad are an anadromous fish, which means it swims out of the ocean and into fresh water for spawning purposes. A large number of the population then die after spawning in our Upper Delaware River. These fish are targeted by shad fishermen from Philadelphia to Shinhopple on our river system. They are now swimming up our river and will be for the next 2 months. Most shad fishing techniques are all very similar. They use a long fishing rod, light line, and a fly or spin reel. Small, colorful darts, jigs, or flies are the best bait. Fishermen will often seek out a nice channel in the river and cast at a downstream angle and reel and do a slight jig or twitch motion as the dart or fly sweeps across the channel. If you are getting stuck often, use lighter darts or flies. Also, if you get stuck, let line out and slack immediately to your lure. It will often become unstuck or unsnagged with slack in the line. But consistently casting at a downstream angle will lead to less snags and more fish. Get out there and try your chance to catch a shad.
If you have any questions regarding trout fishing on the Upper Delaware River, I can be contacted at fish@farmandcountry.org. For WJFF, Farm and Country, and Hooked on Fishing, this has been Evan Padua, casting off.
Fishing season opened on April 1st, and on Thursday, April 29th at 6:30, join Sweetwater fishing guide Evan Padua for a virtual program, Fishing on the Delaware River. He'll introduce regional, seasonal fishing opportunities and provide the best tips and tricks for fishing in the Upper Delaware River. Fishing poles available at the branches for children to borrow. Visit the Western Sullivan Public Library online to register.
This is Stephanie Phillips with Now You Know for Farm and Country. This morning, I'm in Hankins, New York, speaking with Mark Gidley. Mark is an arborist with years of experience, and he's going to tell us how to keep our trees happy and healthy. Mark, what type of tree work do you do?
Well, I started out as a younger man, I did a couple of years here on the East Coast, having qualified as an arborist. And then I was offered a job as a climber and a foreman for a company in Southern California. So I found myself working with subtropical trees, some small and some very tall. They have eucalyptus out there, which are runners up to the sequoias. So they're very wide and tall trees and interesting to work with.
I'm curious about the climbing. Do you use any aids as you climb?
Yeah, when I started out, it was fairly basic, and they are just really branched over, no pun intended, from using a lot of organic type ropes to synthetic ropes, which last longer and basically are stronger. In the old days, they used to climb on something called manila, and manila would really, really rip your hands apart if you weren't wearing gloves. But then after a while, if you didn't wear gloves, your hands would become used to it. And then there's a harness, which has what they call D-rings. And the usual thing is two side D-rings for a sideline and two front D-rings for your climbing line. Nowadays, things have really evolved to the point that they've encompassed a lot of rock climbing bits and pieces with the tree climbing. So now they have things called ascenders and descenders, and implements that do basically both of those will help ascend and descend. What I do is I climb with something called a tautline hitch. Other people use what's called a Blake's hitch. There's three or four different climbing knots. So I don't rely on anything that could fail me. And I just rely on the knot that I tie, and that helps me ascend by pulling my own body weight. And by pulling on the knot, it helps me descend. The other thing that you have are what are called spikes or gaffs. Some people call them cleats or spurs. They are usually affixed to your feet and your shins, I guess you would say. There's a top strap with a pad, sometimes two top straps, and another strap that goes around your boot by the heel area. And these spikes vary in size. Most on the East Coast, I think, are about an inch and a half. West Coast, obviously, certainly Northern California, you're using larger spikes because they're thicker barked trees.
You're talking about an inch and a half in width?
The actual spike itself that you would drive into the tree to secure yourself as you were climbing. So the length of the spike that kicks off from the bottom of the spur where it comes out between your sole and your heel. Some of these spikes have adjustable setups that you can use, like an Allen screw that will take out the spike. So you could take out a 1.5-inch spike and put in a 2.5-inch spike. And then you have linesmen that work on the poles on the street for electrical, telephones, and so on. And quite often they'll climb with just maybe a 3/4-inch, a tiny little spike, because that's all they need. There's no bark to penetrate. It's just straight through onto the wood.
I'm a little confused. Are the spikes on your shoes or something you hammer into the tree?
Okay, I'm sorry. What it is, it's like a J-shaped piece of metal, and that goes underneath the it goes underneath your boot between your heel and your sole. And right where your heel is on your instep, there's a small, it depends on the size. There's a spike that comes out, and that is the piece that you drive into the trunk of the tree or the bark of the tree, left and right to help your ascent into the tree. Now, you would only wear spikes on really thick bark if you're pruning them, but it has to be a very thick bark tree. There's really no exceptions. If you're pruning, you are not supposed to wear spikes at all. In fact, in Connecticut, it's illegal to wear spikes if you're pruning a tree because more often you're causing more damage than harm to that tree.
So you're not hammering in a ladder type thing like the hunters do with their tree stands?
No, nothing even close to that. Some arborists will use a basic ladder to get up into the tree, but these things are affixed to your shin and your boot. As I said, it's like a J shape, and where the J hooks down, there's a piece that kicks out, which is your spike. That stays with you the whole time you're in the tree. You don't have to move them anywhere. They're with you wherever you go.
Can you tell us about some of your projects?
Well, my projects have changed. Now I'm planting more trees, and I'm focusing more on trees' health. I've been planting a lot of fruit trees and putting in orchards, too. Putting in a 6 to 8 foot tree. And if an apple tree is usually 5 or 6 years old, you can expect fruit within a year or so. That's about the time they start producing. And there's a lot of state apple trees. There's one that's called an Empire. There's another one that's called a Liberty. And they are a little more resistant to certain types of fungus that other apple trees have been getting with the recent change in the weather and the moisture that we've had for the last couple of years with the wet summers. So the wet and the heat have been conducive to causing a fungus. And this particular fungus has really done a number on a lot of the fruit trees. So not only have I been planting fruit trees, but a lot of existing fruit trees are primarily apple and pear. Then I've been treating those against different types of fungus.
Mark, how often should you water? And how much water should you give your trees?
Okay. Most houseplants are killed by overwatering, but that's not the case with outdoor trees and shrubs, because the water usually has somewhere to go unless you've not planned that digging correctly for planting. If I am able to, what I will do is I will set up a water timer with an irrigation system. 80% of my customers in Sullivan County are not here full time. So that being the case, they cannot water the trees every morning. And I cannot stop by every customer with a watering can every day. So what I'll do is I'll get a water timer, not expensive, anywhere between $30 and $40. And you hook that up to your outdoor spigot. You can set the time that you want it to come on. And I'll usually set it in the summer months, which is when I'm doing, or spring, summer, when I'm doing most of my planting. I'll set it for 5 a.m. at like a quarter turn on, and I'll have it run for anywhere from 20 to 40 minutes. So it's not going to be too fast, and it's not going to be dripping. It's just going to be a reasonable flow. And my belief, having it run from, let's say, 5 a.m. to 5:20 or 5:40, is once those roots have taken in that water about the same time that the sun's coming up, then everything goes in a cycle. Photosynthesis occurs. It's going to draw the water in through the roots into the vascular system of the tree. And I do it then as opposed to the evenings, because in the evening the water goes down and there's no sunshine out. And it kind of doesn't go anywhere except down. I mean, the roots are going to be damp in the morning, but it's not the same thing, in my opinion. Now, there are different types of watering systems. That's about the most simplistic one that you can get. So you're going to attach a soaker hose to this water timer. And the soaker hose, you'll coil like a snake around the drip line of the tree, which is where most of your fibrous feeder roots are. You can hide it right underneath the mulch so nobody sees it. Ordinarily, if you do that for about a month to 6 weeks in the summer months, then the tree will take care of itself after that. I'll usually go between 1 and 2 months. And again, it depends on what type of tree it is, where it's placed, and what the weather is doing for that particular year as well.
And once the tree is well established, maybe 2 or 3 years old, do you still have to water?
No, but you don't have to if you have quote-unquote normal weather. However, what a lot of people don't realize, they see their trees getting sick. There is no harm in watering a tree, no matter what size it is. I've had a red maple that was starting to show signs of not being well, and we treated it for just about everything we could. But on top of everything else, we put an irrigation system that came from the house, and that is a permanent setup too, because we had more than 1 or 2 years where it seemed to be losing foliage early. And again, we weren't exactly sure, but once we hooked this irrigation system up to the tree, it responded really well.
Mark, what can you do about tree diseases?
Okay. If you've got a tree that's infected with bugs, blights, or diseases, I'll take a look at it, and hopefully I can diagnose what the problem is with that tree, and we can remedy that with different methods, whether it's spraying or some type of a drench that is watered in and taken in through the roots. And then there's different types of capsules and what they call microinjectors that go into the cambium layer of the tree underneath the bark, which in turn, if there's a bug, let's say, that's attacking the tree, if it's underneath the bark, the only way to get to it through the cambium layer is with these little microinjectors. And they'll put a fluid in, and what that does is it goes into the same little chamber that the bugs are in, the surviving in, and killing the tree at the same time, and then in turn that kills the bugs off. So in turn would save your tree.
So once you inject it, it's going to flow upwards or downward as the channels inside the tree move it along.
Sure. Well, with the cambium, you have the xylem and the phloem. Xylem's up and phloem's down. So once you've got that fluid into the tree, it's going to follow through into the vascular system of the tree. And wherever there's anything untoward that wants to feed on your tree, it'll kill it. What's recently become a problem in the last few years, especially in eastern Pennsylvania, and it's working its way to New York now, is something called the emerald ash borer. Arborists just call it EAB. There's different ways of treating trees against this particular little insect. It's a winged insect that is about the size of a dime. You can tell that your tree is being attacked, and usually if you see this, by the way, it may be too late. The entrance hole made by these bugs is just a round hole, and then they'll lay their eggs, and when the eggs hatch, the exit holes are D-shaped. But getting back to treating against these particular insects, there's different ways of doing it. Now, with the micro injectors, again, that would go in. It would put a fluid into the cambium layer. And if these little guys came in to attack a tree, an ash is usually one of the first things they'll go for. They also go for a black walnut. Then it would kill off the bug before it had a chance to kill off your tree. And if you have a really beautiful large ash tree that's alongside your house, your barn, or something that you really like to admire in your yard, then my recommendation is springtime every year, once the foliage comes out on your trees, that's prime time to treat them, because that's when the uptake with the sap happens. So you can treat them with microinjectors, you can treat them with capsules. The capsules will usually last a little bit longer, anywhere up to about 30 months. And then there's also a fluid. Most of the products I'm able to buy online from supply companies in the Midwest. And next to that, I just go to Agway locally, and I'm able to get pretty much what I need to treat the trees. One of the better ways to keep in touch with what's going on is the cooperative extension. And you can also call BOCES and the local forester. The last spot closest to where we are right here was seen in Rileyville, which isn't that far away, just across the river in Pennsylvania.
So now you know how to give your trees the care they need to thrive. You've been listening to arborist Mark Gidley from Hankins, New York. You can contact Mark with your tree questions by email at treeusa@yahoo.com. If you have suggestions for topics or experts of interest to Farm and Country listeners, email me, Stephanie, Stephanie, at wjffradio.org. This has been Stephanie Phillips for Farm and Country.
Here's a Farm and Country announcement that I'd like to share with you. Willow Wisp Organic Farm is looking for part and full-time help this season. Located on the banks of the Delaware River in Damascus, Pennsylvania, just 1 mile from Callicoon, New York, the 30-acre organic farm is looking to grow the team with employment opportunities from April to October. Employees enjoy a hot farm lunch and paid coffee breaks, on-the-job training, and the added benefit of work that brings health and well-being to local soil and people. Interested applicants are invited to email a cover letter and resume to Will-O-Wisp Organic Farmer Greg Schwartz. His email is greg@willowwisporganic.com. That's Greg, G-R-E-G, at willowwisporganic.com. Telephone contact number is 570-982-0050. Once again, 570-982-0050. Experience is not required. Join a great team. To learn more about Will-O-Wisp Organic Farm, go to the website www.willowwisporganic.com. We hope that you enjoyed our show this week, with production by WJFF Radio Catskill volunteers Keith Hubbard, Evan Padua, and Stephanie Phillips. This has been your host, Rosie Starr. Thanks for listening to Farm and Country on WJFF Radio Catskill. Feel free to visit our webpage, wjffradio.org. There you'll find podcasts for local news and resource information for our community. We are sustained by your financial support. Thank you for donating to the station that you rely on, WJFF Radio Catskill. Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit, taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. DamascusCitizens.org.
WJFF listeners are amazing. Thanks to you, we've met our goal for our pledge drive. Thank you. You pledged your support for your community radio station. You have our pledge to keep you connected